Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas is now in session.
Thank you. You may be seated. I want to welcome everybody to the Second Court of Appeals this morning, where we have one case set for oral argument. Before we get started, I'll introduce the panel that we have, and I understand that the attorneys have checked in with the clerk. So to my left is Justice Dabney Basil. To my right is Justice Wade Birdwell, and I am Elizabeth Kerr. So with that, we're ready to get started.
The court will now call number 02-26-151-CB in the interest of SK and AK children. May it please the court. Mr. J. Edward Niehaus will argue for appellant. Ms. Kayla Haynes will argue for the Department of Family and Protective Services.
Thank you, Mr. Niehaus.
May it please the court. Justices, good morning. I'm Edward Niehaus for the appellant mother. In the interest of absolute candor with the court, I recognize that what appellant mother is asking for with regard to alteration of preservation of error rules for jury charge error under Rule 274 is significantly outside the text of the rule. And I had requested arguments so that I may address any questions that the panel may have with regard to the proposed adoption of the criminal standard pursuant to Almanza.
Yeah, let me ask you, because I think if the appellee is correct, it sounds like the Texas Supreme Court has already sort of answered that question. So, and perhaps this is just a way station on your way to ask them to reconsider it, but can we, you know, within the confines of our job as an appellate court of appeals, can we write an opinion adopting your proposed jury charge standard?
I believe you can, yes. The Texas Supreme Court refused petition on in the matter of RWS out of the 10th Court of Appeals, where a substantially similar argument was made, also, unfortunately, regarding the same error in the jury charge on the definition of in danger being outside the scope of what's been authorized by the Texas Supreme Court.
Now, the court didn't refuse. It was denied. And there's a distinction between.
I apologize.
Had the court refused, then that opinion would be binding on us.
Yes.
Okay.
But isn't BLD right on the top of this with respect to preservation? I mean, Judge Wainwright's, you're basically raising a due process argument, and Judge Wainwright, Justice Wainwright, goes on at some length about the due process question and says the balancing is fair without with the present preservation rules applied.
Yes, and again, with regard to preservation, the basis for the court to get there would functionally be a due process, because we are dealing with the constitutional right to parentage, and we are dealing with a lifetime termination of the parental child, the parent-child relationship. If the court were to get there, the opinion would have to be sufficiently narrow so that you're not completely rewriting 274.
Why isn't BLD dispositive of your argument at this point in time?
I don't believe, and I'd have to go back and reread BLD again to be certain. But I believe that in BLD, it was raised as, if it pleases the court, I would prefer not to misspeak. May I file a supplemental briefing on BLD?
Sure.
I don't want to make any misrepresentations to the court.
No, that's fine.
Well, what was the nature of the charge error that was the subject of the BLD finding? And why would the charge error that you're urging here be something that either we or the Supreme Court would go, oh, wait a minute, now this is something new, this is horrible, you know? Just using an example that would be outrageous, what if the charge had said, you know, you are to find there was endangerment, you are to find that there was drug use without, you know, and just basically ordered the jury to make these findings, but for some unknown reason, the attorney for the parent didn't object to that, then that comes up here, and that would get my attention, okay?
Of course.
Definitely get my attention. It might get the Supreme Court's attention. So can you compare the erroneous charge instruction or question or whatever it was in BLD with what you're arguing and why this one might get their attention more than the one in BLD did?
To be frank, I don't know that this one gets their attention any more than the one in BLD does.
Okay.
The charge error here, even if the court is to adopt an Almanza-style secondary preservation rule, we'd be dealing with an egregious harm equivalent on this case, and I don't know that the court would find that the comment on the evidence within the definition of endanger would get to egregious harm, particularly if you compare what we purport is the harm of the jury charge in this case to some of the court's criminal jurisprudence, where the egregious harm standard is basically the omission of an element of the offense or reduction in the state's burden. I don't know that we get there even if the court were to adopt a secondary preservation analysis for jury charge error in a CPS case.
And didn't BLD suggest in the circumstances of Judge Birdwell's question that it might be raised as an ineffective assistance claim, and you're not raising charge errors as an ineffective assistance claim in this case?
I had contemplated doing so. I did not. I opted not to do so based off of the court's reasoning in BLD.
And you're coming to this after the trial completely. You're appellate counsel, correct?
Correct. I was not trial counsel in this case.
Okay. We've all been there.
I think everybody.
All three of us have been there.
I think everybody that stands at this podium has been there, where they get a jury charge and they look at it and they go.
And other things as well.
Yes. And having been trial counsel that's been second guest on appeal, I can appreciate the difficulty of having to be there in the moment and catch every possible objection while you're also talking to your client and planning your cross and making your objections. So I try not to be overly harsh with trial counsel, because I've been there and arguably made.
That's why deep pocket clients are always well advised to have appellate counsel attend trial with them.
Well, let's talk about for a second where you are harsh with a trial counsel.
Yes.
Your brief doesn't discuss Article 3835, which is the article dealing with whether or not licensing is a predicate to the admissibility of a forensic analysis. It seems pretty clear to me that 3835 is limited strictly to criminal actions. Do you have a different view?
I did not interpret 3835 as being restricted specifically to criminal cases. But I recognize that is a question of first impression in this court, and I believe statewide.
Well, I mean, 3835D1 says it's limited to criminal actions. 3835A4F says it excludes an expert examination or test conducted principally for the purpose of civil or administrative litigation. And 3835A2 defines a criminal action as related to conduct proscribed by a criminal offense. So how do you translate that language into applying to a termination?
Since we're in cases like this where termination is based off of quasi-criminal or quasi-criminal activity, specifically the mother's failed drug tests and the mother's continued drug use, I would offer that since the underlying conduct is criminal, that the court should apply a criminal standard for.
Do you have a case that says a termination case is considered a quasi-criminal case?
I do not.
Okay, thank you. And from the standpoint of your IAC claim, Would it have been error for the trial court to have overruled an objection on the basis that these, whoever conducted the forensic analysis wasn't licensed under 3801?
I believe so, yes.
Okay.
Now, you're making a statutory claim that there had to have been licensure, right?
Yes.
Okay. You weren't making a broader 702 argument with regard to lack of expert qualification?
Correct.
Okay.
Because counsel did make a number of objections trying to keep those drug tests out, didn't he?
Yes.
Okay.
She, yeah, but yes.
Okay, she, sorry.
If the court has no further questions, can I reserve the remainder of my time?
Absolutely.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Mr. Niehaus. Ms. Haynes. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Kayla Haynes and I represent the Department of Family and Protective Services in this matter. There's a simple resolution to both of mother's claims in this case. First is that jury charge error was not preserved in the trial court and therefore it was waived. And second, trial counsel cannot be held deficient for failing to make a frivolous objection. Starting with the first issue, clearly termination cases follow the civil rules of procedure and evidence. As mentioned by Justice Basil, BLD is dispositive. BLD considered whether termination cases should follow the fundamental error that was discussed in Almanza, as well as whether there should be a due process concern, and it clearly decided that neither were applicable to parental termination cases.
Do you think that somebody could make a plausible argument to the Texas Supreme Court that they should revisit that analysis?
Sure. I think the Wright case could bring that argument to the Supreme Court, especially in matters regarding, you mentioned ineffective assistance of counsel as well, due to failing to make that jury charge argument. I do think then it should be reviewed, but that's not the case that we have before this court. Going back to Justice Birdwell's question about the nature of the jury charge in BLD, it was, they were complaining about the form of the jury charge. It wasn't a definition, it wasn't something necessarily about the wording of a element that needed to be proven. It was specifically the broad form of the jury charge itself that was being contested. But in JFC before BLD, the Supreme Court did have a case in JFC where they reviewed whether a jury charge that omitted a finding on best interest entirely, whether that was subject to fundamental error. The Court of Appeals found that it was fundamental error for that entire finding to be removed from the jury charge. The Supreme Court reviewed it and they were able to resolve it with by assuming without resolving that issue. So the Supreme Court declined at that point in time to even review for fundamental error or due process considerations.
How did they manage to do that? Because the question wasn't asked, the jury never made a best interest finding in their verdict?
Correct. It used a different provision of the rules of civil procedure specific to omissions in the jury charge, where, if I remember correctly, a trial court can implicitly make findings that were not found by the jury.
But that also is based on the fact that the other party doesn't object to the omission.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And then BLD completely wrote a full decision discussing that fundamental error and the due process considerations. Moving on to issue two, if there are no other questions on the first issue. One correction I would like to make in my brief is that there were two sets of drug tests admitted in this trial court. So the first was State's Exhibit 20. That was drug tests from 2020 and 2024 that were preceding the removal. The second set of drug tests that were offered was State's Exhibit 25. And State's Exhibit 25 was all the lab reports from the pendency of this case. Specifically, when trial counsel made an objection based on the lack of notice under Rule 902 for the State's Exhibit 25 lab reports, that was sustained. None of those reports came into evidence. They were mentioned and discussed at trial, but they were not, the actual lab results were not admitted.
Were the results actually testified about, or were they argued in front of the jury?
They were argued in front of the jury.
Were objections made at that point in time?
Not at argument. Objections were made any time counsel tried to, whether the ad litem or the department's trial counsel made any reference to mother having meth or cocaine in her blood, or that she tested positive for those substances.
During the pendency of the termination proceeding?
Yes.
Because that's what State's Exhibit 25 dealt with?
Yes.
Okay. So there was literally, was there any evidence in the record about her test that the jury could consider about, you know, along the lines of, well, she's still doing drugs, even though she's in the middle of having her rights terminated. So obviously she's, you know, unrepentant or something of that nature.
Well, not every objections were made. Not every objection was sustained.
Okay.
So some of that evidence was still before the jury. Mother admitted to having substances in her system. She denied that she smoked the meth, consumed the cocaine. She alluded that possibly she was drugged, or they were in her system from some other point, but they were alluded to before the jury and trial.
But you're very straight and clear. You don't think 3851 applies?
I do not think 38, no. I think it's strictly the text of the Texas Forensic Science Commission section of the Texas Code of Criminal Procedure, and our point of view is pretty clear that it doesn't apply to civil litigation such as termination cases. Just because it points to criminal activity, it's not tied to a criminal action as the statute.
Aware of any civil authority that has allowed or held that a non-licensed expert with regard to drug determinations has ever been admissible in a civil context? In other words, take it out of the criminal context. I know that's what he's arguing, but essentially it's a 702 argument on the civil side that somebody, because they're not licensed, then their results should not be considered by the court.
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
In the criminal context, we get that all the time because, oh, you didn't actually do the test. Somebody else, you know, and we've said we've got some issues with that because, so that's why now anybody who comes in to testify about a report has to say, I did all the tests again, or these are my determinations as well, kind of thing. So so it's not, the argument's not completely out of left field. It's just he's tied it to the Code of Criminal Procedure, which is very specific that it's a criminal, that it deals with criminal stuff, but the argument still could be made on the 702 side.
I think it also determines of who is required to do the licensing. This statute specifies that they have to be accredited by a specific body. That doesn't mean if a lab's not accredited by this body that it's not accredited at all or it's not licensed
at all.
But
on the civil side, with regard to experts in medical and healthcare liability claims, the Chapter 74 makes it, of the Civil Practice Remedies Code, makes it really clear that you have to be a licensed physician in the state of Texas in order to be able to be an expert and to testify. So there's a licensure requirement. The legislature knows how to do it on the civil side, because I've done it with regard to healthcare liability claims. And if you're not licensed, then too bad. So so there is a civil aspect of it, but the legislature is the one that's making the determination. And here you're dealing with a criminal statute, and kind of the in-between. It's a civil matter, but it's a heightened evidentiary burden. That wasn't really a question. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I was pontificating.
Don't you
again.
Agree, Ms. Haynes?
See, the shock collar is not up here, so sorry.
She's nodding, so yeah.
If there are no further questions by the court, I will ask the court to affirm the order of termination and yield my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Court has no further questions. I will tender the remainder of my time, request that the court reverse, recognizing that we are asking for something very novel, with my appreciation for the court taking the time to hear me out.
Any other questions?
No, thank you.
No further questions.
Well, we appreciate y'all coming down from Denton County, and with that, your case is submitted and you're free to go about your day.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Counsel.